The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Let's open in a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this conference, for the fellowship we get to have, the equipping, the encouragement. I just pray that we will focus on truth, goodness, and beauty as we peer through the Christian worldview, Lord, that we can see all the work of your creation around us and the texts we read, the common human experience that we can glean. God, I pray that we will always cling to Philippians 4:8, that whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, we will think about these things, Lord. Help us to do that and to live our lives for you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, thank you all for coming. It's not going to be as abstract as some of the talks we've had here. I'm going to go into some analysis of Tolkien, Lewis, J.K. Rowling. So if you're not familiar with those authors, they're pretty important in the classical community, except for the Rowling, but the kids, a lot of them know that. So hopefully there's a lot of interaction here. I'll try to repeat what you say, because I have some interactive portions of our program that we can glean from one another's wisdom. Does anybody know what this is? And if you do, will you share with us? What do you? If you had to guess what this is?
I guess some kind of clamp.
Yeah, it's a clamp, right? For what do you think it's the clamp for? A pipe cutter. You're really close. Yeah, it's a clamp that they would put on people's teeth in medieval times to cut through the root. If they had a tooth problem, they would tighten that screw right there. And so if you went to a medieval dentist or a classical dentist, this is what they would use on you. So when I tell my friends that I'm the principal of a classical school and I teach, from a classical perspective, a lot of them are like, well, why would you want to do that? Like, it's like a negative thing. It's like medieval dentistry for them. Like, don't we have new education? Why would we need the classical stuff? And so this is one of those things you have to be prepared to answer as it relates to truth, goodness, beauty, and the Christian worldview. They don't understand the importance of Latin or logic or ethics. Like, yeah, why would you need ethics in business? The Enron, did you ever hear of it? That's not very important, though, but it doesn't make the schools a lot of money, so we dropped that out. So just to be on your guard when you talk about classical education, this is one of the objections that we have to respond to. And so I was recently discussing that I've had started two different great books programs in Minnesota before I came to teach my current position at Westside Christian Academy. And the one person I worked with, his wife, is from India. And she says, I don't think your program is very representative of, you say it's a great books program. It doesn't seem representative of most of the texts in the world. It's just very Western centric. And so you're really missing a lot of culture by not having more Eastern readings. And so because there's this Western flavor for all your reading, and in India, we wouldn't really appreciate all the Western readings you're having there. You know, things operate very differently in India. And so he said, how would you respond to my wife when he asked me this? And I said, well, it's funny she should mention that, because the reason we read the Western texts and the ones we do is because they're great texts. They transcend the human experience so that whether you're in the East or the West, you would appreciate it. You would see aspects of truth, goodness, and beauty in these texts. So insofar as we could find great Eastern texts that also represent these principles, we would read those too when we come across them. But a lot of them that we've identified in the Western tradition, those are the ones we read. But it's not because it's Western that it's good. That's not what makes it good. It's that because it represents these transcendental properties of truth, goodness, and beauty. And it captures these things. And so that's how I'd respond to your wife, that it's not an East versus West type thing. And I said, I'll bet that your wife still looks both ways when she crossed the street in India, because it's either the bus or her, right? And he just kind of chuckled, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to tell her that. I like that line. And so it's something we can keep in mind, that we can apply these to the books no matter where they are in the world, because they're principles of reality that we find everywhere we go. And even in India, you know, these principles apply of truth, goodness, and beauty. It's not that there's a different system of reality there. Oh, you don't have to worry about gravity in India. No, I'm pretty sure you still worry about gravity. They're not jumping off buildings there and suffering no ill effects from that. And so it's just something to keep in mind as we proceed through this. So this is one of the potential objections. You guys are trying to do this Christian worldview using truth, goodness, and beauty as you apply it to different things. That's just such a Western way of thinking. No, it's not. It's actually the way reality is. So that's what we ultimately appeal to, are these principles of reality. They're not Western constructs. All right, and we could think of the way our Christian worldview relates to these different categories of truth, goodness, and beauty. So I'll go through, okay, what is the Christian worldview, and what are the two major competing worldviews that we have to look at? Now, you can have some of those worldviews subdivided, that I don't do that in this presentation. But you can look more specifically at the different types of theism. But we're gonna look specifically at Christian theism here. So rather than Judaism, okay, they might have some different doctrines than us regarding our eternal destiny, because we have more of revelation than they accept. So most of you are familiar with the term worldview. It's pretty self-explanatory. Often people talk about, think of it as the glasses you put on. And the danger of thinking of it only as the glasses you put on when you look at the rest of the world is there's this, the most popular atheist in the 20th century is a guy by the name of Friedrich Nietzsche. Raise your hand if you've heard of Nietzsche. Okay, so the majority of you have heard of him. He's got this view called perspectivalism. It's the ultimate relativism. And so when we're talking about worldview thinking, what we want to do is avoid Nietzsche's perspectivalism. And here's what he says. Nietzsche says, everything is just your perspective. But there's no transcendent perspective by which we can evaluate worldviews. Now, of course, the problem with that is if you're trapped in your own perspective, that guy who's saying you're trapped in your own perspective must be able to transcend all perspectives to say everybody else is trapped. So it ends up being a what's called a self-defeating statement, or self-stultifying. It defeats itself. It's like, well, how are you able to transcend all the perspectives to say everybody else is trapped in their own perspective? Okay, so this is one of the dangers of saying, oh, there's only a strictly a worldview that you have to abide to, but you can't actually ever get outside your worldview to actually see the way reality really is. This is actually part of the legacy of Immanuel Kant. Raise your hand if you've heard of Kant. Okay, his starting premise is this, that there's this noumenal realm, which is the realm in itself, and there's the phenomenal realm, which is the world as it appears to me. And we can't ever get out to the way the world really is. That's the noumenal realm. But you can comment all you want about the phenomenal world or the world as it appears to you. And so to summarize it in one line, he says, you can't know anything about reality. Okay, that's the foundation of his system. Okay, and at which point I want to ask the Kantian, do you know that about reality? That you can't know anything about reality? Well, then you do know something about reality. So again, it ends up being self-defeating. So we do say that we know reality, and we know these principles of truth, goodness, and beauty because of the way the world really is. And so if your worldview doesn't reflect the way the world really is, you reject that worldview. And we'll see how the other worldviews fall short of the Christian worldview in a sec. Okay, so give me some reasons. Why should you study worldview? This is the interactive portion of our program.
Because it affects every person.
Yes.
Every person. In order to communicate and love one another, you need to know what they really think and how they're...
Yeah, so everybody has a worldview. If you really love them, you're going to find out what their worldview is. And then, yeah, it'll help you share the faith with them. Yes. So in order to live in the world as it really is, your worldview should comport with reality. And if it doesn't, you should abandon that worldview. Yes. That's great. Yeah. So you can identify when students come to you, they say they're an atheist or a pantheist, that is a worldview. Or they may say, I don't have a religion. I'm an atheist. You say, well, actually, secular humanism is a religion. Even the Supreme Court has identified it as a religion, and it's the official religion of our public schools. Yeah, those are all excellent answers. I think it's fun to study worldview. So then when I watch a movie, then I'm like, oh, that's this worldview, and I have fun engaging with it. Oh, that's inconsistent. You know, Yoda's contradicting himself here. Or whatever, if it's Star Wars. I remember one apologetics conference I took some students to. At the end of the time, we're sitting there and we're watching a Disney movie, and I start identifying the worldview and the problems with the worldview. He's like, I just want to stop thinking. Will you please just turn it off? Like, hey, man, I'm just... Isn't this fun? He's like, I'm going to another room. Bye. Okay. So it's a lot of fun. We could use it for evangelism. And hopefully for evangelism, one of the things you could create in people is a state of cognitive dissonance. That's a really cool term I picked up at seminary. And basically, if you have contradictory views within your own system, you don't realize it. You try to create in the person like, okay, yeah, I don't believe it. Ultimately there's good or evil. But you just offended me. Like, wait a second. Are you saying that was bad what I just did? But on the other hand, you're saying there's no good or evil. So how could something be bad if there is nothing bad? Oh, I had never thought about that. So creating this cognitive dissonance in somebody, okay, you have to abandon one of those views if you want to get rid of that. Like, okay, I guess I do. Okay, there is good and bad, and the only thing you've done bad is the way you've just offended me. Or I had one student write a paper arguing for moral relativism. There's no right or wrong, good or evil. Well, you guys know what I did. F. I gave them an F. That's right. Because they use blue ink. I don't like blue ink. So-and-so used blue ink. Well, I don't like your blue ink. That's not fair. That's not right. And wait a second. Didn't you just get done arguing? There's nothing fair, nothing right. There's no good or bad. Okay. I see your point, Professor. There is good and bad, and what you did is bad. Okay. Okay, I will alter your grade because now you're persuaded for the moral case. So on the one hand, you wanted to hold this. As soon as it hits you that there's no good or bad, you realize, okay, I'm wrong. And I heard another professor do that, so I was like, oh, I'm totally using that when I get to teach. Here's some of the tools that you guys may have heard of some of these books. These are my favorite books on studying worldview. So you go to conferences like this, you know all the different ways to be equipped. This is excellent. True for You, But Not for Me by Paul Copan. Excellent. One-liners that he gives one-line response to one-liners that are supposed to leave Christians speechless. So you're trying to share the faith and you share the gospel with somebody. They say, that's true for you, but not for me. Well, he gives you a 2 or 3 page summary of each of these one-liners. And then he'll give you a one-liner to say back to them to continue the conversation. So it's not just, hey, shut up and don't share the faith with anyone. You shouldn't force your view on me. That's another one. Or you shouldn't judge. Okay? Well, is that your view, that you shouldn't force your view? Yes? Well, then why are you forcing that on me? Oh, I guess I am. Okay, well, you shouldn't judge. Was that your judgment? Yes. Well, then why are you judging me for judging others? Oh, I hadn't thought about that. I guess I am judging. So you're doing the same thing you're saying I shouldn't be doing. So he has like 20 or 25 of those. And he has a whole series of this, but this is his first one. True for you, but not for me. Excellent resource. Nancy Piercy, Total Truth, excellent book. She basically takes, she was a student of Francis Schaeffer. Some of you guys are aware of him and his worldview studies. She basically takes the Christian worldview, applies it to all these different areas. Excellent work. We also have Universe Next Door, a handbook to different worldviews. So this is a little thicker for some people, but basically it's a catalog of, okay, what do the pantheists think about these seven different areas? And then you contrast that with what the atheists think. What do the Christians think? So it's just, it gives you a survey like, oh, okay, if I was a consistent atheist, this is what I would believe. And the fourth book is my book that just came out, Reading to Grow. And 24% of the people, this is a new study, a Gallup poll from May 15th of this year, 25% or 24% of people in the U.S. think the Bible is actually the Word of God. 27% of people in the U.S. think that the Bible is no different than Aesop's fables. Okay, so if we're talking about a biblical worldview, this is a book that defends the Bible and tells you, okay, how is it that we should interpret the Bible? Why are there different translations? I deal with a lot of these different things in my book. So these could be some good resources that I'd recommend for you to help equip you as you're thinking about truth, goodness, and beauty, Christian worldview. With a lot of our students, we don't realize how not only are they affected, but their parents are affected. Okay, so Barna just released a poll, and this May 9th of this year, where they studied people who take their faith very seriously, attend church regularly, and say that they have a Christian worldview. So in his study of the people that say they have a Christian worldview and take the Bible and their faith very seriously, only 17% of people have a Christian worldview who think they have that. And so these are probably the parents of the kids who we're teaching. Because they, hey, I want my kid to have a Christian worldview. I'm sending him to a classical school because I know they're going to do a robust job there. Okay, and the parents play a big part of the moral foundation, the worldview foundation of our kids. Also, as part of that study, now these are the people who say that they take the faith very seriously. 61% hold to new spirituality. We used to call this a new age, to beliefs consistent with new spirituality. 54% hold to what are considered postmodernism, beliefs that are consistent with postmodernism. That's a huge percentage. 36% hold to Marxist beliefs. 36%, so that's Bernie Sanders and his ilk, and more extreme than that. So they would read something like the Communist Manifesto and like, wow, this actually sounds really good, and have no problem with a lot of it. 29%, and I'm surprised that the number is actually so low, but they hold to a secular belief, secular atheistic belief. And these are the people that think the Bible is the Word of God, they have a Christian worldview, and so he just surveyed them on these topics. And these are huge numbers, and these are the parents we're dealing with, the ones who actually take their faith seriously. So you could see the need for this. Okay, so I was going to ask for a survey of the main areas of Christian worldview, but rather than interacting too much, we'll just talk about them. Every worldview talks about something about the nature of reality, and within that reality, is there a God or not? So our Christian view is that, yes, there is a God, and he's triune, and he's personal. Okay, so that's opposed to other worldviews. There's absolute right and wrong. And so we're going to use all these standards to apply to the three texts we talked about earlier. Man's not God, but he's created in the image of God. He's sinful. There's both an immaterial and a material reality. Okay, and this is really important when you talk about the spiritual realm of angels and demons, and realizing that our real battle is the spiritual enemies of darkness that we're fighting, and that the people around us that we're trying to evangelize are actually captives of the enemy. And so it gives you a different way of thinking about them. Rather than seeing them as the enemy, you start thinking, okay, they still have the Imago Dei. They're fallen, but they're captives that we have to rescue. Salvation comes by belief, not by works. That's unique to Christianity as well. The Bible is the word of God, and it gives guidance. And especially when, you know, such a small percentage actually believe the Bible, that's pretty important for the Christian worldview. Reality is knowable. Sorry, Immanuel Kant. Different than what he's saying. So, and obviously the skeptics would deny that, but even the skeptics can't hold their position. They're never skeptical of their skepticism. So they might start at Rene Descartes. A lot of you guys know the name of Rene Descartes. Well, what was his famous saying? I think, therefore I am. Okay? So if you want to summarize the problem with him, is he had Descartes before De Horse. So he starts with his I think, and he moves to I am, his existence. Well, he couldn't be thinking unless he already existed. So it's circular and question begging. And so he started with his famous method. It was methodical doubt. And he thought, this is a way I could figure out that God exists. I'm going to doubt everything I could possibly doubt. And I'm going to apply that to every aspect of reality. Unfortunately, he didn't apply it to his own system. I doubt that methodical doubt is the best way to start. Because there's certain things that are just, everybody knows, kids know, that Descartes was doubting. And so you have the rise of all the modern philosophy and skepticism. Thank you, Rene Descartes. But it's this foundational starting point that he never turned on itself. So from the Christian view, we all recognize a ton of things about reality we know. And we come to reality with thousands of truth you've imbibed from your mom and dad before you even get to school. And you want to expand that knowledge. Also, we have to realize about the cosmic battle, and we've referred to this a little bit, but it's especially important when you refer to the fantasy we're going to be examining, because you see it in some of the texts, and the forces of darkness and forces of good, and that occultism is condemned as evil in the scripture. So there's also two different types of naturalism I'll draw your attention to. These are other two major worldviews, but they're both different types of naturalism. So most people recognize atheism as a materialistic naturalism. There's strict laws, material laws of cause and effect. And so they have different view of man. Now, of course, there is no God, but man's basically good. What's funny about them saying man is basically good is they deny that there's any ultimate good or evil. So there can't be any real morality. There's no good or evil, but man's pretty good. Now, wait a second. So this is an opportunity for you to create cognitive dissonance in them. Like, wait a second. If man's basically good, but at the same time you hold there's no ultimate good or evil, how do you reconcile this? There's no ultimate meaning in life. Okay? And some of them brag about that. That's really important for me to realize there's no overarching meaning, so I could create my own meaning however I want. Okay, that ends in despair and suicide. With pantheism, just like there's material laws with the atheism that have a strict cause and effect, pantheism says there's these immaterial laws, there's spiritual laws that you have to tap into. And once you could tap into that, then you start realizing this immaterial realm can be manipulated in some way. And so they have certain laws of like karma. If you operate a certain way in this life, you're going to reap the rewards for that. Or if you're bad in this life, you're going to reap the consequences of that. And so, but the primary thing operating there is... That's right. That's exactly right. So how does karma make sense if there's no good or evil? That's exactly right. So the whole system breaks down when you start putting them next to each other. Because karma is supposed to be punishment for evil or reward for good. But at the same time, there's no good or evil. And material reality is just Maya, is just an illusion. So you're seeing how there's internal contradictions. They're not internally coherent. And the problems and solutions of the different systems, I think, is very revealing. So in the Christian view, we've all sinned, and we're separated from a holy God because of that sin. And the solution, salvation by faith in Jesus Christ and what he did for us. And it's revealed our authority is the Bible, where he shares this with us. In atheism, the real problem is we're basically ignorant, but hey, we're pretty good. So we could come out of that ignorance. So we need to re-educate ourselves, and we're going to solve that. The solution to the problem is education through government schools. So the authority is the government there. For the Christian, the authority is the Bible. Hey, if we just, you know, everybody's basically good. He screwed up because he just didn't know what to do. So let's smarten him up. We'll teach him, but let's not punish him. For the pantheist, you need to be enlightened. And you need to get in contact with your true self. And so the real problem with you is you're unenlightened. And the solution is, hey, our salvation comes through enlightenment, and you realize you are God, and you could become one with the universe, because that's all is God. Okay, so it's their authority is self, ultimately. The authority is government and atheism, and the authority for Christians is the Bible. So here, when you're looking at the definition of truth, goodness, and beauty, I use this character to analyze what he's saying. Truth is typically defined as a correspondence to reality, or sometimes there's an identity to reality. So if what you say is the case, then that's true. If what you're saying is not the case, it's false. So with this gentleman here who's holding a sign, his family was kidnapped by ninjas, and he needs money for karate lessons. Okay, so if what he's saying is really true, that his family was kidnapped. Now, what's funny is I've used this slide for like 8 years, and this is my first year realizing it says kidnapped instead of kidnapped. I was like, wait a second, that just says kidnapped. Okay. I was like, okay, I know I got a, like two jokes in one out of it. And if what he's saying is true, if his family really was kidnapped or kidnapped, then it's true. If it corresponds to reality, it's true. If it doesn't, it's false. So Aristotle says, his definition in Metaphysics 4, if you say a thing is and it is, or a thing is not and it's not, then it's true. So, you know, a lot of people have on their wall the little crochet thing, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. At my house, I have Aristotle's, if you say a thing is and it is, or a thing is not and it's not, then it's true. No, I'm just kidding. I don't have that. But I want that. That would be really cool to have on my house. Yeah, Aristotle's dictum up there. Yeah. When you're looking at the definition of good, now there's many ways to apply good, but the two different definitions I give here are, one, we're referring to metaphysical goodness. And in that, there's analogies between things. So if I say a steak is good, it's different than saying maybe a tree is good or a squirrel is good. They're good in different ways. So, or a student is good. Okay, so we could think of different ways that good applies to these things. In some way, there's some perfection that resides in them that makes it good. So whatever the qualities that makes up for a good steak, it's going to be different than what makes for a good squirrel. So a squirrel that only eats toothpaste, that's probably not a good squirrel, because it's going to die pretty soon. Or it likes to chase car tires, but only when they're moving. Like, that is not going to be a squirrel long for this world, right? So we can identify there's certain things of the nature of a squirrel that makes it good. There's certain things in the nature of a thing that makes it good or evil. If it's lacking something, then, okay, that's evil. It's the Christian view of evil is that it's a privation or a lack in things. So if we say, okay, it's evil that a person is blind, but it's not evil for a rock to be blind, because that's not in the nature of a rock to see. But it would be evil for a person because they ought to be able to see. So think of evil as a privation, goodness as a perfection in a thing, in the nature of a thing. And if you deviate in some way from your proper end, no, our proper end is of man is God. Anytime we stray from him, our heart goes after him. The Old Testament calls this idolatry. So all the sins we do, we're committing spiritual adultery there. We have idols that we're chasing instead of God. And so we're deviating from our proper end. So all these acts that are bad are sin. But when we're in accordance with the way we ought to be acting toward our proper end, then these are acts that are good. And so we can analyze behaviors like that or things in nature. And then beauty has these three characteristics. They're usually described in literature as wholeness or some type of perfection. Proportion or harmony, you could think of how a beautiful song resonates in your soul. And it's not discordant like my microphone was when they were testing it. That was obviously not beautiful. Or radiance or luminosity. And this is different than Yoda's line, luminous beings we are, not this crude matter. So he's saying, okay, you're kind of a glowing creature thing there. No. What we think of is, okay, how does this thing shine? And so when these three things are together, there's some type of beauty that we recognize. So, oh, look at the clear marks of that. Okay, that's beautiful. Oh, this is lacking things. As it's fading over time, you notice some of the beauty it might be fading of a painting or something as it's exposed to the weather and the light and so forth. So you can use these tools to help you evaluate truth, goodness, and beauty in literature. And so that's the easiest place to do it, but you could also do it in other subjects. So fantasy novels, I've had friends object to me critiquing fantasy novels because my initial thrust is, hey, all these fantasy novels still propose a worldview. And we can recognize the worldview and use that to discern certain things about it to critique it. And so I heard a very popular Christian apologist who, I'm not going to say his name, you would know him, and you'd be stunned that he said this, but he just basically, when the Harry Potter series came out, he said, you guys cannot be critiquing that because that's just fantasy. So, and it reminds me of, this would be the same Christian apologist who would object to some of Dan Brown's claims in the Da Vinci Code, if some of you guys remember the Da Vinci Code, where, okay, well, there's a different history that Dan Brown's writing. So he'd be the first one to say, oh yeah, we can refute that, but don't be critiquing Harry Potter because my grandkids love that and it's a fantasy. So it's not really harmful. So we can look as to whether that's the case, whether it's harmful or not. But what his critique is that you shouldn't even critique it. And that's what we're just trying to make the case that, okay, all fantasy novels still propose a worldview. And they claim things about God and about reality and about the nature of man and how we should interact with nature and about what is good and evil. And insofar as they do that, we can critique them. Okay, so that was this objection. And we all recognize the reason we're getting our kids to read great literature is because we know it influences our kids in the way they view the world. And it forever impacts them. Richard Abanis has this great line. It's there in your notes. The real beauty of folk and fairy tales is that they can communicate to our children truths and virtues in an uncomplicated way. And so we want to... people ask, how do we build virtue in our kids? Well, one way is through the literature. Okay, in addition to shaping their hearts and minds, really addressing the issues of the heart, the literature they're reading is teaching them moral lessons. And Lewis recognized this as well in his writings. He explicitly writes with that purpose in mind. So another interactive portion of our program, what are some good truth questions that you would ask of literature? Yes, does it reflect absolute good and absolute evil? Yes, that's a good truth question. Any other? Go ahead.
Where good and evil exist, are there, for lack of a better term, covenant and sanctions?
Okay, where good and evil exist... Yeah.
Is there covenantal sanction? In other words, is there blessings for obedience?
Yeah. Yeah. Is there blessings for obedience to good? And are there curses to deviating from the good in some way? Are you? Yeah. Do they? And that is really important. That's a great question. So, what are the consequences for people's action in the book? Are you rewarded for evil? Are you punished for good? That's an excellent point. Yeah, go ahead.
What's the worldview that's communicated?
Yeah. What is the worldview that is communicated? Yeah, and that's just a matter of a truth question. Like, okay, I've made no criticism. I'm just identifying the worldview. What is the truth of the worldview that's being communicated? I'm not making any moral assessment yet. We could just identify that. Good. These are all excellent points. Okay, so some of the ones I have there in your handout. What worldview is given? How is truth portrayed? What's the view of man? So these are the worldview questions. How is the sacred treated? So there's a guy named Philip Pullman who calls himself the anti-Lewis. And some of you may be familiar with him, but he has several books. He's also British. And in his books, he just paints the church in the worst possible light. You could say that they're the most hypocritical, terrible, judgmental people that you could possibly be, filled with hate, no grace, no love. And reading his books is very painful. And so luckily, they did not sell well in America. So I was really afraid, because they sold pretty well in Britain. And the first one was called The Golden Compass. And so they made the movie The Golden Compass, and it just bombed. I was so thankful that it bombed at the box. I was like, yes. And so we don't want the anti-Lewis running around. But if he was able to be successful, we could still use that to evangelize and share the faith. So I'm not saying not to watch it. I'm just saying that if you see how the sacred is treated in that, it gives you the tools to analyze, like, okay. Some of my friends who are Protestants, they're like, well, they're just attacking the Catholic Church. Like, guys, that's an attack on you. Because when other people have a vision of Christians, that's who they envision, most of them, is the Catholic priest. So you don't realize that they put you under that, even if you don't consider, well, I'm not Catholic, I'm against them too. Like, guys, that's actually an attack on Christendom. That's how they view Christendom. So when they're painting the church in a terrible light, like, oh yeah, and they're doing all this, like, they're thinking that's what you're doing too. So just realize that they paint us with a broad brush. How does it treat matters of right and wrong? What's the moral theory it's promoting as being good? And then this is really going to come to task with the Harry Potter series, because it's very different than what you see in Lewis and in Tolkien. How are gender roles treated in the characters? And so is it appropriate for the certain ages that, okay, Rowling's audience is 8-year-olds, and okay, what's they doing with the kids at 8 years old? So those are good questions asked. What are some good goodness questions? Yes. Yeah. So you could look at whether the relationships in there or marriage is treated as good or evil. Or if you look at, like, modern sitcoms, like, how is dad treated in almost every modern sitcom? He's a fool. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's backwards. You know, he's the most ignorant of everybody in the house. Yeah, we got another. Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. You could actually use Philippians 4:8. Like, the Bible actually says something about reality. Whoa, cool. It helps us with our worldview. Yeah, excellent. Good point. And there's a lot of moral things in the midst of that. Yeah, what's really cool, if you look at even the order of it, truth, goodness, beauty, you see that come out in that order. Well, those are great. Yeah, go ahead. Does it promote virtue? That's right. What does it think of virtue? And what are the virtues it espouses? And does it promote what we consider to be virtuous? Yeah.
Since ultimate goodness is God himself, mm-hmm. What is the view that's communicated of God through whatever you're reading or whatever you're watching?
Yeah.
Even in the underlying tones.
Yeah. What is communicated about God? Is he good or evil? Or, yeah. Is he malicious? Yeah, excellent. Good. You could also view this morally. Are all things good? Like, doesn't matter what the characters do? You know, that's communicating a view of morality, and it's teaching our children an ethical theory. You could also ask about the plot and the writing. Okay, sometimes the writing is very clear, but the plot is terrible. It's like, wow, I understand everything they're saying, but this is just a terrible story. So the writing might be clear, but the plot is bad, or vice versa. Like, wow, this is an amazing story. It was communicated a little more clearly. Or both might be clear. If you're reading Lewis, it's like a breath of fresh air. Like, wow, he communicates so well. I want to write like that. You could also look at how Christianity is portrayed and Christian morality in particular and see, okay, Philip Pullman just completely denigrates Christian morality. It's patriarchal and all these things. You could think of different socialist writers. Marx sees our Christianity as being patriarchal, and somehow in any state of marriage, the husband dominates the wife, so we need to abolish marriage. So these things could come out in the text like, okay, this is not a Christian view. And you can look at the moral lesson at the end of the day. And that came out also with when we were looking at truth, whether certain actions are rewarded or punished based on what they are. Okay, how about beauty? What questions would you raise? We'll just do one. Yeah.
What did it draw you to? How did it make you feel? What were you drawn to accomplish?
Yeah, what did you feel? What are you drawn to? Does it help you order your loves properly? Does something in it resonate within you? Like, wow, this is how it should be. Does it evoke in you a certain longing? And Lewis really tries to capture that in all his writing. And that's one of the things he explicitly says for children. He wants it to draw on them a longing for something beyond themselves. It's longing for something greater. And we all desire that. Don't we all have that in our heart? Like, wow, okay. We know there's only one in whom we'll ultimately be satisfied is the living God. The one who is truth, goodness, and beauty. We experience those things in a finite way in this world. And we capture little periods of joy, like, oh yeah, I figured out that problem. That is awesome. Oh, I gained this new truth. That is amazing. Oh, look at that beautiful sunset. And then it passes, like, oh, I'm longing for something more. And then when we see him, we'll be completely fulfilled with infinite truth, goodness, and beauty. Yeah, so he'll ultimately capture our heart and all our desires and can fully satiate our minds. You can look at the beauty of the writing style. How about the noble characters? And you could see the beauty in their actions. We long for their noble deeds to be done in us. We want, okay, I want to be like that. You leave the movie theater, I want to be like the hero. I don't want to be like the villain. Man, that guy was disgusting. It's repulsive. You know that's a good movie. When the bad guy is actually repulsive, you're like, wow, that is a good actor. He's actually playing the part really well. When you start liking the bad guys, that's the problem. It's actually really hard for people to act as a lot of our modern good guys. It's really hard because they seem so fake and one-sided. It's like, okay, a lot of them aren't dynamic. But you start liking the bad guys because they're really dynamic and they're funny and they can do whatever they want. And it's like, oh man, I'm drawn to the bad guy. There's a problem with that. And so being able to distinguish that in the story goes really far for us evaluating it. And if it is hard for us to evaluate that as adults, think of how it is for our children. Like, oh man. Yes. Anti-hero is a huge motif right now in Hollywood. Yeah, so you're watching the Avengers and you start liking Loki. Now, some of you don't know my reference, but Loki's like hilarious. He's just busting out joke after joke. Man, Loki is funny. Like, thank God that there's an Iron Man who also makes jokes. But then, at the same time, the Tony Stark Iron Man character is nothing virtuous. It's like he's a womanizer and all these other things. Man, why you gotta ruin the character like this? So you want your kids to be more like Captain America. Like, okay, he's just gonna do the right thing every time. Okay, that's cool. But it's Hollywood is the new medium that our kids are imbibing these virtues from. So it's good to be discerning of these things. So these are good questions to ask, okay? So there's all these different categories you can apply this to. All of you teach one or more of these subjects, probably more, given that you're classical school teachers. And then some are you not only more, but different every year. So you've probably taught every grade of every subject. So it makes it easier to make interconnections, though, doesn't it? This might irritate some of you, because you're nerdy enough to get the reference of Jean-Luc Picard saying, use the force, Harry, signed Gandalf. So how to irritate four groups of nerds at the same time, right there. And these are the fantasies we'll be looking at. Now, I'll be going through this quickly because our time is short, but this is a lot of fun. So when you're just comparing these things, superficially, there's similarities between Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and Chronicles of Narnia. You'll find references to the life-giving power, blood, immortality, rites, rituals, wizards, and magic. Okay? Now, you'll notice from my slide, though, with the Harry Potter magic, it's magic with a K. In Tolkien, in Lewis, it's magic with a C. Okay? So the magic with a K, the reason it's spelled with a K is occultism. When you read books on witchcraft or occultism or go to their websites, they always spell magic with a K. And that is the type of magic that is in Harry Potter. And that's the significant point when you look at the differences between the magic in the different books. If you look at the location, this is a question you ask, okay, where does this occur? I actually just read an article really recently about how J.K. Rowling has improved our world and changed all our kids. That for the first time ever, the jocks and the kids that were reading all were reading the same thing. We all experienced Harry Potter and Hogwarts together. And we all, when we turned 11 years old, we were all longing to receive a letter to go to Hogwarts. And we felt disappointed when we didn't receive that letter. And it was like in the Huffington Post. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is just crazy. So after J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, she received thousands of letters from kids who wanted to attend Hogwarts because the setting is in London and it's a real world setting. Now, Lewis received no letters requesting entrance to Narnia. I dare say no kid actually thought that if he would have sent Lewis a letter, that he would have been allowed entrance, because Narnia is a different world altogether. And so the setting of these places is something that's significant. But in addition, if you look in Lord of the Rings, there's a huge contrast between the good and evil characters. Okay, good characters are virtuous in Lord of the Rings. And then if they stumble, oftentimes they're redeemed. There's a moment of redemption for them. There's very clear lines of demarcation between good and evil. Even when they're being tempted, you could still see those lines very clearly. And there's an absolutist worldview consistent with the Christian worldview, whereas there's a utilitarian and relativistic worldview promoted in Harry Potter. Evil is often rewarded. Draco Malfoy, who's one of the main evil characters Harry Potter series, is often punished for reporting something that Harry did that was actually against the rules. So Harry's rewarded for breaking the rules, but Draco, for following the rules, is punished. And he's seen as the evil character. And that's how he's painted. And it's like, okay, there's something going on here beyond what is normal for what we see as, okay, that's not right. And we can recognize that. We're in a unique position, especially having the Bible guiding us in our moral sensibilities. Like, okay, we're actually in a better position to evaluate these things than other people who reject the scriptures. Magic could be good or bad. In Lord of the Rings, when magic is encountered, that it's always seen as bad. Okay, and I'll get to the point of Gandalf in a second. So my friends who love Harry Potter are like, but Gandalf's a wizard, he's using magic. Okay, it's very different with Gandalf because he's actually not human. He's this creature called a Maia. So if you read Silmarillion, which is another Lewis work, he talks about the existence of these wizards. They're actually angelic beings called Maia. And the magic they do, the magic with a C, is just like writing is to us and reading. It's just a natural thing to them. It's not occultism like you have in Harry Potter. So the way you increase your power in Harry Potter is through increased occultism, increased acquaintance with magical spells. Well, that's not the case with Gandalf. When God saves Gandalf after he encounters the Balrog, some of you are familiar with the series, he moves from Gandalf the Grey to Gandalf the White. He's given more power. He's elevated in his status as this angelic being. It's like, hey, you just got a promotion as an angelic being, and he's given more power to exercise his gifts. But at no point is he using occultism like you have in the Harry Potter series. One of the things that really concerned me when I started looking at the Harry Potter series is you can go to different websites where they promote occultism, and the witches who are writing on these websites say, study Harry Potter for a good introduction to occultism. The books that J.K. Rowling is very familiar with occultism, and the books that Harry Potter's studying, your kids could study along with him because they're real books on occultism. So when he's like, oh, first year Harry is studying this, well, you could go on Amazon and study those same books on occultism. They're real books on witchcraft, and you can order them for your kids. And the second year, those are all real books too. So it's a little crazy to say, okay, there's a real world parallel to the occultism. There's real historical characters that she's using in there who are real world occultists. So it's very different. You're not going to go out like, hey, you guys want to go meet Aragorn for coffee tonight? Well, you recognize Aragorn is a character, or you're not going to go say, hey, let's go see if we could find Aslan running around out there. Unless you actually knew somebody named Aslan, but you're not thinking you're going to go find the lion, because these are occurring in different worlds. Whereas some of the characters in her books, there's actually universities named after some of the characters in her books because they're real historical characters. And you could study occultism at these universities based on these characters. So I'll let you do the research, but it bears it out. So real world setting, real occult instruction, you know, that's enough for me. In addition to promoting the relativism to our kids, and that Harry is rewarded for doing what is evil and constantly defying the authority. It's like, oh, he's rewarded for doing it. Why? Well, because he had good intentions. What do they say about the road to hell? That's right, paved with good intentions. Lewis, here's one of the things he wrote. Since it's so likely children will meet cruel enemies, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage. And when he's writing, I found this great line. He was writing about writing Christian literature and why Christians should continue to cultivate the life of the mind and write fiction. So you have these Oxford dons like Tolkien and Lewis. A lot of people are criticizing, why are you wasting your time writing children's fantasy? And so in response to this criticism, this is one of the things that Lewis writes. Children have the knowledge that they're born into a world of death, violence, wounds, adventure, heroism, and cowardice. With this in mind, they recognize that there's good and evil. Let our stories have wicked kings, battles, dungeons, giants, dragons, and let the villains be soundly killed at the end. So they have an acquaintance of these things. I think it's just really powerful when we think about, okay, why are we teaching our kids this Christian literature? And why do we contrast it with some of the modern fantasy? And it's good. I'm not saying that kids shouldn't read this. I'm just saying that be aware of what they're reading. And you can evaluate from a Christian worldview. So some of the older kids, it might be fun to have dialogues like, hey, so what is the worldview? What's the ethical system? Like, you might really like Harry, but why should you? What's noble about him? Let's list all his virtues. Oh, he lies consistently. He doesn't. Now, should you be drawn to him? Okay, let's look at all his vices. Oh, boy, big line. So you could do that with, you know, Epic of Gilgamesh, whatever you want. But we can do this with our fantasy literature. So the bottom line is, if it's promoting virtue in the readers, like Tolkien and Lewis were trying to do, then it's good literature. If it's not, though, we have to be aware of the destructive forces it might have. Narnia bears little resemblance to occultism. Okay, and ultimately, you see their stargazers, the astrologers, the centaurs are stargazers in Narnia. Well, if you read to the last battle, you find out the stars are living beings. Okay, so this is actually the ancient view of the world, is that all the stars in the heavens, according to Aristotle, there's either 49 or 55 unmoved movers, but these are some type of living entities. Okay, this is what Lewis is bringing over, is that the stars are living entities, and they're communicating messages from Aslan to the centaurs. So the centaurs, who are stargazers, that's what they're getting. They're getting revelation from Aslan through the stars. So it's not like astrology that we would condemn. That's a very different thing. The rightness and the wrongness basically comes from the one who's wielding the magic in Narnia. So Aslan, it's legit. He's the creator. He could do what he wants. These are like miracles, okay? So his magic. But when the White Witch, she's an illegitimate authority. So when she does magic, the reason it's so destructive and terrible is because she doesn't have the authority to do that type of thing. And so you see that coming out. She's so wicked. And the people she encounters, they turn to stone. So ultimately, the power is the distinguishing feature of the magic in Narnia. And you look at how evil is defeated, differs from Narnia to Harry Potter. Basically, you just use the occult powers better in Harry Potter. Like, oh, we're using the same type of things, but we're using them better than you to beat the bad guys. Whereas in Narnia, if you align yourself with the king, if you align yourself with Aslan, he's going to ultimately defeat evil. If you align yourself with the forces of evil, then you will be defeated. Okay, so you could think of different ways that we can apply these to history and science. It's really easy to do it in many ways in these, because you have the biblical history, and you could say, okay, how is our history being attacked? And how does what the secular history says different than what the biblical history? So just one example from history that I immediately caught when I was teaching from a secular history book. We know that the earliest humans were all nomads and wanderers. And I'm sitting there reading Genesis like, well, I'm pretty sure the first thing that Adam and Eve were in a garden, and they weren't wandering yet. And then, okay, they were driven out. But then after Cain kills his brother, he's told he's supposed to spend his days wandering the face of the earth. But instead of doing that, he starts a city. It's like, okay, well, I'm just seeing city dwelling from early on, and farming and gardens. So I'm pretty sure that the secular history is different than the creation account. And just to be aware, okay, this is the secular history of the world. How does it contrast with what Genesis has revealed to us? With science, my admonition usually to science teachers is to be precise in the language. So let's use Darwinism to refer to macroevolution. And then we consistently call macroevolution Darwinism. So when our kids are there in the college and they leave us, they say, I don't believe in evolution. They're like, well, what about all these dog, different breeds of dogs? You don't believe in that? Or finch beak variation? Which we all know is examples of microevolution, but we put it under the broad term of evolution. Kids are like, oh, yeah, I guess I do believe in evolution. Because we haven't equipped them to make these distinctions. But if we call macroevolution, making that distinction, as Darwinism regularly, then it's much easier than, I hate the word evolution, only because it just means change. Yeah, I evolved. I just changed my position. oh, I evolved again. I moved back. So if it just means change, that's all it means most broadly. But what the Darwinist will get you to do is agree to this innocent definition of change, and they'll swap that out with Darwinism. Like, you do believe in Darwinism. I'm like, what did I just agree to? So some of our students aren't discerning enough to know what's going on there. So the math and physics, just let me refer you to the Fibonacci numbers, the golden mean, Fibonacci spirals. If you're completely unaware of what this is, you could watch videos online. I was going to show you one, but I'm just about out of time, so I don't have to do that. But these are real easy to find. So you look up Fibonacci in nature, and you'll find these incredible designs in nature that have the fingerprint of God. Like, whoa, it's like it was created this way. Like, whoa, okay, you think? Okay, so our main takeaways, okay? Applying truth, goodness, and beauty. There's a battle for our kids' hearts and minds that we're continually involved with. And we can apply all these different categories to the different classes we're teaching. And Roosevelt writes about, he's got this great line, it's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or how the doer of deeds could have done them better. You guys have heard this, right? A lot of you are shaking your heads. The credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs. We all resonate with that. Who errs, who makes mistakes again and again. But there's no great effort made without errors and some mistakes and some shortcomings. But he doesn't stop them from let that stop him from his task. Who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, the worthy cause for which he works. And that's what we're doing. It's a noble task we have in front of us. Who at the end of the day, at his best, will know the great triumph of high achievement. And who at worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly. So he knows his place will never be among those cold and timid souls that have never known either victory or defeat. And so I give you the charge to go out, realize the battle we're in, keep the hearts and minds of our kids in view, and equip them with these tools so that when they leave us, they're just not parroting something back, but they're equipped to face the world. So be watchful, stand firm in the faith, be men of courage and women of courage, be strong. Good day.